and public, we have first we had this agenda scheduled for Wednesday, and we ran into a number of conflicts on Wednesday. The forecast was released. We had session on Wednesday, so we put this off to Monday. We have a fairly full agenda today and also on Wednesday, and by next week we're going to try to close out the hearing of the bills and start putting our article together. So if we could, we'd move promptly through the bills today. Senator Wergen is going to be presenting Senator Ingebrigtsen, Senate File 342 for Senator Ingebrigtsen. Senator Wergen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Senate File 342 is quite simple. Most of you, I'm sure, are familiar with the tax abatement statutes that are available for counties, townships, cities, and school districts to use for purposes of abating taxes rather than some of the tax increment financing things and things like that were available in the past. This bill simply says that the abatement may include delinquent taxes, interest, and penalties. I will readily admit there is a downside to this bill. It could, in some rare instances, encourage not paying taxes and having them forgiven later after your business is sold. I don't foresee that happening. The reason it probably could be a good statute if it were written more narrowly is the instance where, and I'll just give you a for instance, a campground that was in trouble and didn't pay taxes in my district when I was a county commissioner. When that property was sold, there was substantial back taxes, but the new owner also had to do a substantial amount of cleanup. They had to rip out old infrastructure. There was an enormous upfront cost for the new owner. So that would be an instance where it would come in handy. But it's probably could use some cleanup and a few things like that, although the idea, the concept, could work in rare cases for some counties. So that's what it does. It just adds that you could use abatement for back taxes, interest, and penalties.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. And currently they can abate the interest and penalties or taxes going forward, I believe. Is that correct, Senator?
That's correct. Well, under current law, I understand that they could probably already, they wouldn't even have to abate. They could just forgive the interest and penalties. But this goes back with the abatement statute and says that it can be used for that purpose as well.
Okay, thank you. Members? Okay, we will lay Senate File number 342 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. And Senator Wergen, you have Senate File 389, which is a bill that was in the K-12 division that we asked you to bring over to the property tax division because of the alternative mechanism for calculating property taxes. Looking for the language. Sections 2 and 3 and sections 4, I believe. Would you want to talk about sections 2, 3, and 4? We'll leave section 1 out of the discussion as that's would be a subject for the K-12 finance.
I will, Mr. Chair, and thank you. And I have some folks here from Foley that will join me at the table, if you don't mind. And they are aware of the changes, so we'll forego some of the testimony so that we don't get into the explanations of the first parts of the bill and just try and deal with these. Mr. Chair, Senate File 389 has been around in, probably three or four different forms over the past several years. There is an odd thing that has happened with using the sales ratio, especially as it relates to maximum effort levy districts. Originally, maximum effort levy districts, which are the school districts that have very low property wealth and even low income wealth, they tend to be the poorer areas of the state. And so when they do bond referendums, the state equalizes those bond referendums. And when it started out, it was a 28% payback. What has happened because of the use of the sales ratio and the complications of our property tax system, inadvertently, the changes in land values and some surrounding issues have made it so that those poor school districts are having to pay back a lot more than they thought, and that all gets put back on property taxes. So I'd like to look at you and just say, this is a great property tax relief bill, so let's just do it. But it is a very complicated property tax bill. Currently, those loans are, the payback is based on the net tax capacity of the district. And then there is a formula that goes into it to form the adjusted net tax capacity, which takes some things out of the equation, and limited market value enters the picture also. What this bill does, in order to get back to the clean intention of maximum effort levy payback, it would switch the formula from the adjusted net tax capacity back to the estimated market value for payback of those loans, and in that way clean it up and bring those property poor districts back down to an affordable amount of payment back to the state for their levies. So it instructs the commissioner to redo a formula for payback, and then the limited market value in Section 4, if that's what you're looking for part of it, is also pulled out of the equation because it distorts the property tax system significantly for the payback of these loans. That's the quick and dirty explanation of what this part of the bill does, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. And you have testifiers with you. If they would identify themselves, please.
I'm Michelle Zeck. I'm the business manager from Foley Public Schools.
Karen Kipka, board member, District 51, Foley.
And did
you want to go first, Sharon?
After the big snows of the past week, being here is kind of like coming out of hibernation. And we all know that as true Minnesotans, we have two choices, to hibernate or to celebrate. I'm from Foley, Minnesota, a wonderful rural community about 80 miles north of here. Today, I represent not only my district, a maximum effort loan district, but all school districts in the state of Minnesota. I also brought with me today the lady in the know here, our business manager, Michelle. This year, our truth in taxation hearing played to a packed house. I'm constantly getting complaints about property taxes, and for every complaint I'm getting, I'm betting you're getting tenfold or more. Property tax relief is a huge issue among your taxpayers. They feel overburdened, and Senator Wergen's bill, Senate File 389, offers a solution with a realistic price tag. You have the questions in front of you today. Why do this? The largest portion of school district property tax is debt service, 36% of all levies. Operating levies are 33%, and 31% of all other levies. Debt service levies are equalized across the state using adjusted net tax capacity, ANTC. ANTC is net tax capacity divided by the sales ratio. Senate File 389 proposes replacing the ANTC with debt service net tax capacity, or DSNTC, to remove the distortion in ANTC caused by limited market value, LMV. Why is it important this change be made? Limited market value, LMV, is a statewide policy through Pay-09 and therefore through fiscal year 2011 for school districts. LMV includes green acres, which are not sunsetted. In other words, the problem extends beyond 2011. Districts with significant LMV have low sales ratios, which artificially inflates their equalization value, ANTC, and thereby lowers their state aid. Since bond payments are fixed, any reduction in aid means an equal increase in local property taxes. This means that district property owners of all classifications pick up the cost of the state policy of LMV for school facility bond payments. Michelle will lead you through the rest.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Kapka and Ms. Zapp.
As Board Member Kipka said, 36% of all school levies is debt service. In Foley, we have approximately $3.1 million levy. Of that, 73% of it is our debt service levy. Only 7% of it is operating, and 19% of it is the other levies. It's extremely difficult in our district to pass a significant operating levy because of the debt service levy in our district. Senate File 389 proposes that we change the current sales ratio calculation from the assessor's market value divided by the limited market value, whichever is lower, divided by the sales price, to just the assessor's market value divided by the sales price. This proposal removes the effect of LMV from the sales ratio and returns the sales ratio to its original purpose, which is adjusting for assessor's practices that truly equalizes aids and levies. This change has a larger property tax reduction in capital loan districts because those 21 districts have to tax their taxpayers 28% of ANTC, and the sales ratio, as you know, plays a big part of that. In Foley, our current sales ratio is 66%. It has dropped over 10% from the previous year, which is the reason, in the end, that we ended up with a packed house at our truth and taxation hearing. With this proposal, our sales ratio would increase to approximately 81%, which would significantly lower our property taxes for debt service. Let's look at an example from House Researcher for Property Tax, Steve Hines. This home would have a sales price of $100,000. Its estimated market value is $90,000. Its limited market value is $60,000. Under current law, ANTC would be $600 divided by 60% or $1,000. If you times that by 28% in a capital loan district, the property tax paid would be $280. If you use the proposed calculation in this simple example, the assessor's market value, you would take $600 divided by 90% or $667 and times that by 28%. The capital loan district would pay $187. That's a $93 savings to our taxpayers in that example. In the fiscal note, you will note that there is a cost to this program to change this formula. Approximately $1.4 million in fiscal 09, a little over $1.2 million in 10, and $1 million in 2011. I'd also like to point out that in paragraph 4 of the fiscal note, under the assumptions that the proposed change provides additional debt service aid to two distinct types of school districts, the fastest growing school districts, which tend to be located near suburban areas, and districts located in areas with significant amount of seasonal rec property. It is these types of districts where the spread between the limited market value and the estimated market value tends to be the greatest. Districts qualifying for debt service equalization aid and having relatively large amounts of limited market value or green acres property are most affected by the change and will receive corresponding increases in debt service equalization and decreases in their debt levy. In Foley, this change would save the property taxpayer an estimated $222,000, with a corresponding increase in state aid of $40,118, which is a 9.7% decrease for our taxpayers on our debt service levy. I'd like to point out that not only capital loan districts would see a savings in property taxes, Osakis would save approximately $144,000, which is a 12.3% reduction. They would receive some extra aid of $21,568. Upsala would see a reduction of $102,890, but would also see a corresponding increase in aid of $102,890. So their decrease would be 15.7%. And there's many districts that would see no impact at all.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Zapp. And members, as the Ms. Zapp and Ms. Kapka have demonstrated, what the problem is here is as we use, as limited market value takes effect, it skews the mechanism that the counties are using for valuing their market value for equalizing for schools. And if it was just for limited market value, that will expire and it would be less of an issue. We do have bills, and we will be hearing a bill the next time we meet, I believe, to extend that. So that's why this language is here. Also, as Ms. Kapke has mentioned, Green Acres is a factor in this also, and we do have a recommendation from the department to reevaluate the Green Acres program. So I think as we are considering those bills, it's going to be important that we take this mechanism that Senator Wergen has presented to us and keep that in mind in order to make sure that we're equitably equalizing in these school districts. Do you have any questions, members? Anything else, Senator Wergen?
Mr. Chair, if I can give you just a little bit of a real picture of what this does in some of these districts. Foley and areas like that that are outlie the metropolitan area by not too great a distance. In the state demographer's most recent publication and in one other tax publication by a nonpartisan group, it shows that this is an area of the state where the cost of living is only 1% below the metropolitan area. It's only 1% below the metropolitan area for the cost of living. However, the wages, the median wage, is 33% below the metropolitan area. So when these folks, when their taxes are going up because of the sales ratio and how it skews things, these folks with 33% wage average below the metropolitan rate and only 1% below in housing are hit particularly hard because they're in the maximum effort levy districts. And so this makes a substantial difference to those 21 districts and a slight difference to most of the districts throughout the state. And that's what makes it good relief. It actually ends up going where we need to do some property tax relief. And your district is one of them that's impacted also.
Thank you, Senator Wergen. Anything else? Okay, Senator, excuse me, Senator Wergen, we're going to lay over Section 2, 3, and 4 of Senate File 389 for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Thank you, Senator
Thank
Wergen.
You, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, witnesses.
Thank you.
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Senator Langseth.
Last I'd heard, they were expecting farmland property taxes to go up another 13% this next year. And over the last 4 years, they've gone up very substantially. So what my bill would do would just make a few adjustments, not necessarily to reduce the tax, but at least reduce the tax from what it would be otherwise. On the farm homestead, it's been 0.55% of value. This would just drop it to 0.5. So that by itself wouldn't eliminate the 13%, but would still modify it somewhat. And on the lower tier, well, we used to have a tier that was 3,500ths of 1%, and that was changed. So on the first 115,000, there was actually a credit. And what this bill would do would raise that amount from 115,000 to 150,000. In fact, I don't think that would even quite come to inflation from the first that was put in. And then it takes a cap from the homestead that says it can't be more than four townships distant from the farm homestead. The Senate had that in a few years ago, and then it was said in conference committee, well, that would mean people from like the Twin Cities could have a homestead any place in the state. But I certainly think it could be written in a way that you had to be an active farmer. And my idea is that there are people in Minnesota that have farm homestead, and then they have owned land more than considerably more than four townships away, and they don't get homestead on that, even if they haven't come up to that homestead cap of, what is it, 690,000 now. So it would seem like that could be written in a way that it would limit it to two farmers, and I'm not sure about that. I also know a situation where a farmer, he actually moved down by the lake and lost all his homestead, but he's involved in the production of the farm. I mean, he is an active farmer. So I think we should take a look at that and see how that could be worded in a way that a farmer, an active farmer, could maximize that homestead. And it probably isn't written right here. I'm not sure, but I would think that we could figure out something there. But those are the three different provisions of the...
Well, thank you, Senator Langseth. With regard to the active farming point that you were just talking about, we're looking at a couple of different provisions when we're redoing the Green Acres program that puts some income criteria on the person applying for Green Acres to ensure that they are farmers, and we're taking income off of this federal Schedule F, and I'm wondering if that might be something that you would think would work in this area.
I expect it would. What happens on a year when they lose money? Would the zero count?
Well, Senator Langseth, we're looking at, I think we have one out of two or one out of 3 years, they have to have such a, I think it's 25 or 30% of their gross family income coming from the Schedule F. So we're kind of, this is an area that we're exploring, and we're not there mm-hmm. yet either. So yeah. This might be an area we could
yeah,
look
I,
at.
I think I'd appreciate it if you just kind of see if you can make this workable from a legal standpoint.
Okay. And Mr. Clavin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bruce Clavin, I represent the Red River Valley Sugar Beet Growers Association, and just spoke with Senator Langseth on Thursday about his bill. He mentioned a gentleman who moved in his district, and that guy is one of my board members. And so he asked me to work on this bill this year, and I told him that I would do that. And so when I saw the bill up, I told Senator Langseth I would make a pitch for it as well. The suggestion on the farming, as I was listening to the discussion here, you might want to look at 500.24, for example. That's the corporate farm law. You might find yourself a farming definition in there. I can't remember. Also, in terms of the Schedule F, whether it's income-based or not, we would want to make sure that captures partners who would file a K-1 or the corporate tax return you'd file, which is an 1120 or an 1120S if you're a subchapter S. That might all be reported on Schedule F. I can't remember. But certainly capturing those is something you'd want to look at if you're monkeying with those definitions. And so that's my testimony in terms of the bill, Mr. Chair.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Clavin. Questions, members? Thank you, Senator Langseth. There's a Mr. Bob Mole, he's Ottertail County Assessor, would like to speak to this bill, Senator Langseth. Mr. Mole?
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Mole. I'm the Ottertail County Assessor's Office. Ottertail County Assessor, I'm speaking on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. The removal of the four township distance limitation in this bill will greatly add to the complexity of homestead administration of agricultural property. Currently, under the four township distance limitation, a number of property owners have what assessors call cross-county homesteads. Some of the agricultural parcels in these cases are located in two adjoining counties. Adjoining counties need to coordinate administration of these cross-county homesteads and the resulting credit calculations between the two counties. Removing the distance limitation would allow a farmer or farm operator living in southern Minnesota to also own farmland in northern Minnesota, creating the need for coordination between counties far removed from one another. This will drastically increase the complexity of administering agricultural homesteads. The coordination of taxable values and credit calculations would be necessary from a county to anywhere else in the state. When we have coordination between adjoining counties, it's a little bit easier to do when we're going from one area of the state to another, it would be very complex to administer. I'd be happy to answer any questions if you have any.
Well, Mr. Moe, you were listening to our discussion about actively farming, and what if the person applying for homestead had a actively farming criteria or some income percentage from farming criteria in order to qualify for homestead? Does that would that work in your to make it easier for the assessors to evaluate?
It works when you have the four township limit, when you have Mr. Chair, committee, it works when you have that four township limit, so you have it more defined. If you were dealing with someone living in the Twin Cities and they have a farm up in Otter Tail County, it would be very hard to administer that, to coordinate that between those two areas.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Moe. Well,
Mr. Chair, it would seem like
Senator Langseth.
The landowner would have to take the initiative and apply for it rather than the assessors taking the initiative.
Mr. Moe?
Mr. Chair, the problem is the actively farming or special ag homestead requires reapplication every year, and we do have problems getting people reapplying. We have it, that creates a lot of administration. Even when we're within a four township limit, it creates problems, and extending that beyond four townships would be very complex.
Okay, well, Mr. Moe, we'll stay in touch with you or the Assessors Association as we work through this to see if we can come up with some solutions there. Thank you, Senator Langseth. Okay, we'll lay
you.
Senate File 545 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Senator Fredrickson? She's sitting here, Senator Fredrickson. Oh, there she was. I didn't see her. Welcome to the committee, Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members. Good morning. Senate File 330 deals with split classification of property where an individual or family lives in a part of the building and the other part is typically a retail business. And this issue goes back about 6 years. Prior to 6 years ago, there was borrowing allowed to come up to the maximum homestead classification amount. And with the property tax reform of, I believe it was 6 years ago, that was abruptly scheduled to end, with a resulting increase of like 2.5 times the property tax payable. As a result of a bill that I and others, I'm sure, presented then, the tax committee decided rather than allowing that to abruptly change, it was changed more gradually. I still think it is very unfair that we do not allow that so that the owners of these properties who live on those properties can obtain the full amount of the homestead valuation. I'd like to give you a little picture of typically what these properties are. There's one in downtown New Ulm. It's called Bookshelves and Coffee Cups. It's a small business, a retail business. It's a neat place to go look for a used book and buy some good coffee. And the proprietors live on the second floor. And I have that proprietor with us today to testify to the committee. It's Jerry Chamberlain. He's the owner of Coffee Bookshelves and Coffee Cups. I forget whether the coffee comes first or the book comes first. But if Mr. Chamberlain has been caught in this and has been in communication with me and can give you a firsthand explanation of how this affects him.
Mr. Chamberlain.
Thank you, Senator Fredrickson. Mr. Chairman, the rest of the members of the committee. As Senator Fredrickson said, my name is Jerry Chamberlain. I've been living in New Ulm for 10 years now, running a business with my wife. We're the sole proprietors for the business. And when we set up our business plan, we looked at everything and realized that one of the ways we could make our small business go was to take advantage of the residential valuation borrowing if we lived above our store and didn't have a home four or five blocks away. And that's how it was for the first 5 years. When the legislatures passed the property tax reform of 2001, at that time, all property taxes were supposed to be lowered, commercial, industrial, residential, farm, 10 to 25%. In regards to the split class for commercial, residential, homestead, the reform simplified it, and it did give a break. What it did was it raised the first tier up to $500,000, but it also eliminated this borrowing clause, which only affected the first $76,000 of that part of the building that was the homestead, the living quarters. Now, when this first happened 5 years ago, I thought this affected everyone who would be split class, residential, commercial, but in reality, it doesn't. Anyone who had a higher value property, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 property, and they were still having an apartment that they lived in, they weren't affected by that at all. If anything, their taxes went down just as everyone else's taxes went down because the portion of their apartment was already at that $76,000 level. What it really affected were the older buildings, probably more in greater Minnesota, the smaller towns, where the value of the building was only $70,000 or $100,000 in the first place. When this passed, my property taxes in 2001 and the value of my 120-year-old building, brick building, was only around $70,000, $80,000 to begin with. In 2001, my property taxes were $667, and that was part of the plan for the first 5 years that I was dealing with. In 1 year, the property tax went from $667 to $1,638. So that's 250% increase, 150% increase up to 250% of what I was paying. That's $1,000 more a year. My family is surviving on a total income of around $20,000 a year, and we're making it work. But that $1,000 increase really cut in. Now, all that, as I understand it, the property tax reform was at a time when the state was giving back $900 million in property tax and reforming everything, and that was great, and you put it through. The only problem is when 2002 rolled around, we're post 9/11. We're post tech stocks going in the tubes, and now the state was dealing with deficits rather than surpluses. Plus, you already worked in the reduced taxes for all the property taxes, so there's less money coming in, too. Now, at the time, as I understand it, because I was in a little shell shock back then, but I've had a chance to dig a little more, Senator Frederickson and other legislatures all had different ways of fixing this solution. When it came to you, and by the way, thank you, you allowed me to speak in front of your committee 5 years ago. When everything was said and done, I understand that you had to compromise and combine all the different bills to look at some relief. And I also realize that you're dealing with deficits rather than reductions. And we do appreciate what you did pass back then. Basically, you didn't correct the situation, you only delayed it. In 2002, we had to pay that full amount, that $1,600. Then you gave us a step-down program so that in 2003, instead of the $660, we had to pay $900, and then following $1,200. 15, 16, until it got up to that level, and then that's where it stayed. So you never corrected it. And if this was an oversight and you planned on doing this to small businesses and retired people, because in the long run, that's what affected. I can think of two scenarios for anyone who's going to have living quarters above, say, an $80,000 to $100,000 building in Brainerd, in Grand Rapids, in New Ulm, and that's couples like my wife and I who are running a small business, and we're doing it in order to live above the building to take advantage of that homestead, and that's the only way we can make a small business work. It's going back to the old way of life where the property owners live above their business. I can see a small number of people like that. I can also see retired people who ran their business for 30 years also living above their building. And now maybe they're retired, but they still live in the same apartment that they've lived in for 30 years. They own their building outright. They lease their retail space to have some income coming in. They're also, we're going to be hit with these huge increases. Anyone else who had buildings, as I said, in the $300,000, $400,000, $500,000 value range, they wouldn't have been affected at all. If anything, their taxes would have gone down. So I can see this as being more of a greater Minnesota concern. And although I appreciate what you did before, like I said, it seems more like you just delayed the situation. You didn't fix it. I waited 5 years for some representative or some senator to go back and readdress this issue. And then I realized this is a squeaky wheel situation. All I had to do was send one letter to Senator Fredrickson and remind him of what was going on 5 years ago, and he immediately brought this bill back, so I'm very grateful for that. So this is me personally. Now, what I would also like to see, and Senator Fredrickson suggested I mention this at this time, is if you didn't intend for a small property owners to hit that huge increase, 600 to 1600, and I'm just an example, I'm sure depending on the values of the buildings, it may have been a little more, a little bit less, but if I'm average, if you didn't intend for this to happen, you can go back in reverse and put in that $76,000 limit, of which we're allowed to borrow at the residential homestead rates. But I would also like to see you amend it to give those few of us, and I'm guessing it might only be 1,000 to 2,000 property owners, give us a rebate for what we've had to pay above and beyond for the last 5 years, that $1,000, $500, $750 more. A rebate would probably be a few million dollars, maybe $3-4 million. I don't know the numbers. And each year, if you fix this, you're only talking a difference of $1 million in property tax if the increase is roughly that $500, $600 times 1,000, 2,000 properties. Those are the numbers that I'm just trying to glean from all this. I'd like to see the amendment where you go back and give us that money back. Now, you talk about how property taxes are increasing in the last few years on the farmstead, the homestead, commercial, all taxes go up. We know that. But all those taxes that also have gone up since 2001 affect people like us even more because we're doing it at that basis. We're starting at 1,600 instead of the 600 that we had worked out in our business plan when we went into business 10 years ago.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. And
thank you for listening
and
to me.
Senator Fredrickson, I'm glad you brought this forward. You're refreshing my memory. I also had some constituents, particularly a family that lived above their hardware store, and I had kind of forgot about this. So this is very good. Members, questions? Mr. Hagan?
Mr. Chairman, members, John Hagan with the Department of Revenue. I'd like to briefly weigh in on this, I guess, and with all due apologies to Senator Fredrickson. We think this is really bad legislation. The borrowing concept that the witness discussed was, in 2002 it was removed, and the way the old borrowing worked was a person who occupied a residence that was a split-class property, a commercial property most commonly, used to get homestead up to the full homestead first break, which was $76,000. As part of the 2002 reform, they increased that $76,000 to $500,000. The legislators correctly realized that if they did not remove borrowing at that point in time, there would be no such thing as a split-class property in most of the small-town Minnesota. And any of these properties that were split-class residential commercial would go entirely residential because that tier moved up to $500,000. It was quite a cliff to fall off for people who did have homesteads above the property when they totally removed it. Consequently, the legislature revisited it and put in the two-year phase-out period, trying to give the property owners an opportunity to prepare for that tax cliff. We think it's really bad policy, and that does require a great deal of computer programming and a lot of administration for a very small number of people. It's also a departure from the concept that we, as property tax administrators, are trying to move towards where a property owner pays tax on their homestead, as in the case of a farm where they do the house, garage, and 1 acre. In all properties, the tax attributable to the homestead reflects the actual value of the homestead and not some artificial value such as borrowing creates, where you'd go from the residential value and borrow into a commercial or an apartment value. Consequently, we would urge you to leave the law as it is.
Well, Mr. Hagan, when they're valuing the home portion of this building, is there kind of a standard percentage, or how do assessors arrive at what portion is the home value and what portion is the business value?
Mr. Chairman, there is no standard percentage. It's just based on the assessor's knowledge, and they try to determine how much value would be added by the apartment above or a house in the same parcel of property or whatever the case may be. They would just try to do an ad valorem estimate like they do in all types of property.
Okay. Okay, thank you, Mr.
Could I address that a little bit?
Senator Fredrickson?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think our public policy should be to try and maintain viable Main Street businesses in our small towns. And one way to do that is with the bill that I have before you. And I think it's also good public policy to try and encourage individuals to live downtown. That's what I hear folks like Mark Fenton, urban planner and expert on livable communities. That's what I hear a lot of people talk about, is getting individuals to live near or in their businesses in downtown areas. It's what keeps our downtowns viable, what keeps them very pleasant places to be. And I think what I have in this bill would promote that. And Mr. Hagan's assertion that this would be a very complex issue to administer, with the computers that we have now, I don't find that much of a persuasive argument. I think that the assessors and tax administrators could handle this just fine.
And Senator Fredrickson, I also think that we need to keep in mind what Mr. Chamberlain said, that this primarily did hit at those businesses whose values are low to begin with. So we'll take that into consideration.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Moore.
Oh, Mr. Chair and Senator Fredrickson, you know, I was just in thinking through this, that it's not just small towns and small downtowns. I think there are corridors in the metro areas where we're trying to revive specific corridors. And, I mean, you know, a number of the Senate members here have eaten at my brother and sister-in-law's restaurant, and they run the restaurant on the first floor, and they're living in the top floor. So I know that, I mean, I'd like to help to try to see if we can address this, because and many of those are just kind of a small mom-and-pop business with a, you know, apartment on top, and if we could help them, I think it would be very helpful, because it keeps the business viable, but we're building a really good landlord who is running their business and living in their mixed-use unit, so.
They're there 24 hours a day. You know, they're there watching their property in the community all the time, which keeps those communities safe and livable. Right. Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much for listening to our bill.
Thank you, Senator Fredrickson and Mr. Chamberlain. And we'll see if there's mechanisms that we can use to help you. And thank you for bringing this forward. We'll lay Senate file number 330 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Senator Fischbach. Welcome to the committee, Senator Fischbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate file 486, it basically what it does is it changes the local government aid reference for regional centers as opposed to the 2000 census, it changes it to the current number of in the population, because we've got a city, Sartell in particular, and Mayor O'Driscoll is here to help me explain this, since I'm probably not doing the greatest job. But right after the 2000 census, they flipped over to a population of higher than 10,000. And so their LGA was based on that lower amount. And there are, I think, six other cities that this affects in the state of Minnesota, and I think that probably the best thing to do is for me to turn it over to Mayor O'Driscoll and let him explain a little bit better about what's going on with this.
Mayor O'Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to once again visit with the committee relative to this item. If it's the wishes of the chair, I do have a handout that I would like to provide the members.
Sure, we'll get it handed out.
Thank you. As Senator Fischbach had indicated, that in the LGA formula, there is a tie to regional center aid when a community reaches 10,000 or more. And that number has been pegged by state statute to the U.S. Census number of 2,000. Interestingly enough, our neighboring community on the east side of our corporate municipal limits of Sartell, Sauk Rapids, had just passed the 10,000 mark in population, where the city of Sartell was just below that. And to put some numbers on that, the city of Sauk Rapids was about 10,300, and the city of Sartell was about 9,650 for rough figures on that. So within less than 700 residents between the two communities, one is entitled to regional center aid and the other is not. So what does that mean to the city of Sartell? It means until such time that provision and statute gets changed, we are tied to a formula that puts us at a city of less than 10,000 people. And that would be fine if we had just barely eclipsed the 10,000 population. As the handout that I provided you shows, on the front cover of the little pamphlet that outlines our community, we are approaching 14,000 people in our community. In a matter of 7 years, our population will have increased by 40%. Now, that doesn't seem like a lot when you're talking about a community of almost 10,000 moving to 14,000, but it is all relative when you start factoring in the city of Minneapolis or the city of St. Paul or any one of our other larger metropolitan areas seeing a 40% increase in population. The city of Sartell, prior to the 2002 budget cuts that had ensued in the previous legislative sessions, we were receiving LGA under the old formula. And again, I'm being optimistic, I guess, when I say the new formula, the formula change that we're advocating here today. Under the current formula, we were seeing about $620,000 in local government aid. Today, 2007, we have been reduced down to $62,000 in local government aid. So we are operating on about a 10% transfer than what we had previously seen from the state of Minnesota. Our budget in the city of Sartell, our general operating budget, is about $5 million a year. So we are talking significant dollars for the city of Sartell. In the information that I've provided you, again, I've outlined that there's a handout in here that provides some general demographic information about the community. In the left pocket, you'll also see that we work as a regional area in the city with the cities of St. Cloud, Wade Park, St. Augusta, St. Joseph, Sauk Rapids, and Wade Park. I've provided, in the way of backgrounding, some information on the legislative priorities that this group has put together. And you'll notice that our number one legislative priority in bullet point number two indicates the correction in the LGA formula. It doesn't have the current House or Senate file numbers attached to it, and the reason for that is this is not the first time that we've attempted to discuss this matter and hopefully get a correction in this. As many of you know, we've been down here many a legislative session looking for this change, and we felt that we came very close to that last year. Senator Scoey, you were on the conference committee that addressed this issue, and we did just fall short of it. I think that the state is recognizing, and so is the legislature, that this is an item that needs to be considered very seriously, regardless of any other LGA changes that might be made. The reason why I think it needs to be addressed is it is the only component in the LGA formula that pegs transfer payments under the LGA formula to the U.S. Census and is not subject to the demographer's annual estimates. All other provisions within LGA, with the exception of regional center aid, ties the number to the demographer's estimates. The next item that's in the left pocket are some of the things to get you to become more familiar with the city of Sartell on paper. If I had the opportunity and if you would ever be interested, I'd be happy to tour you around our community and show you some of these facilities that I'm referring to in here. When we talk about the Sartell area becoming a regional center of 14,000 people, We have a number of medical clinics that have located or are relocating from the city of St. Cloud into Sartell, into our regional medical arts campus, due to expansions and the expansion of need with health facilities. You'll see that there are a number of different clinics, and we've highlighted some of the major facilities within the community. And Sartell continues to enjoy the designation, if you will, or the distinction of being an area that will continue to see medical expansion growth. On the second page of that handout that talks about the regional components, you'll also see that a quick trip through town, we have two full-service grocery stores. We are one of the only communities that has a Coburn's grocery store that has two grocery stores located in the community. I'm sure you're familiar with Coburn's Grocery throughout the state of Minnesota. The only other community that has two Coburn's groceries would be the city of St. Cloud. A number of financial institutions within our community, a number of eating establishments, the relocation of the Boy Scouts from the city of St. Cloud to the city of Sartell. The St. Cloud Board of Realtors has taken up home in the city of Sartell. We have our own newspaper, 10 churches within our community as well. If you drop to the bottom of the page, you're going to see it talks about school facilities. Within the corporate municipal limits of the city of Sartell are located all of School District 748's facilities, which provides educational services to some 3,000 children. Not all of those children are residents of the city of Sartell. Many of them are residents of the neighboring townships or other cities within our school district. So on a daily basis, we have individuals who travel to the community on rural section roads and are continuing to travel on rural section roads that are now a part of the city of Sartell due to annexation and due to the growth of the community. And we're finding it more and more difficult to be able to meet those transportation needs as well. One of the other items that I think is worth noting is that within the school district, there are some 400 full and part-time jobs that are tied to that as well, that are not simply filled by people who are within the city of Sartell. We also have a number of those communities that are to the north and to the west of us that travel through our community to go to St. Cloud for employment, as well as other commerce that they are not able to get in their communities. And as the area continues to grow with the hub cities in the central Minnesota area, we continue to experience what we believe is a disproportionate amount of burden that we're picking up without the benefit of the LGA formula correction, moving that pegging number again from the 2000 census and letting it free float with the other demographers' numbers when calculating the LGA. I know that once you start peeling back the lid on LGA, everybody wants to be on board with that and has a great idea. However, this is not something that we're coming this year to the legislature on. It's been something that we've been coming to the legislature since 2001. And our situation only continues to get worse as time goes on. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand ready for any questions.
Thank you, Mayor Driscoll. Senator Moore.
Mr. Mayor, the growth in Sartell, is that what's attributing to that? Do you have a lot of new homes that are being built?
Mr. Chair, Senator, Mayor, yes, Driscoll. We do. We have a lot of new homes. We, in some respects, are blessed in the city of Sartell, where we have a very, very positive and well-established school system, which draws a lot of people to our community. And that has spurred a lot of growth, as well as the quality of life that we provide. We have a lot of recreational parks. We also have trail systems, which are used almost 24 hours a day. I live on or near one of those trails and go out on those at all hours of the day and night myself. And I see other residents out and about. It's a community that has experienced substantial growth. And going back in the history of our community, we've never once fallen short of a demographer's estimate of what our population would be. And we are slated by 2020 to be near 25,000 people at this point. So we are definitely on a growth path within our community by 2025 to be at about 25,000 people. So we realize that the formula is the way it is, but we're saying in this case we believe it makes some sense to look at least this component.
Follow up, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Wong.
Mr. Mayor, and how do you provide your services, your fire and police? Do you have your own departments, or is that in conjunction with other municipalities?
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Mayor.
We do have 17 full-time sworn police officers that are full-time employees of the city of Sartell. And we also have three administrative support people for our police department. We have a 30-member volunteer fire department or pay-per-call fire department, and many of the things that we have within our community are done by volunteers. Supporting the police department, we also have 8 volunteer police reserves that help out with different kinds of school events or other community events where police presence is needed or felt it's important to have that type of presence. We also have many volunteers who help with our city parks and our gardens, who are volunteers through donation and other private solicitation. We receive money that we buy plantings, that these groups go out and adopt a park, adopt one of the flower beds within our community. So on a $5 million budget, we have 41 full-time employees within the city of Sartell. And so we think that we're providing a pretty good level of service. We just don't want to fall behind in those types of things. One of the other things, which is not an item of today's discussion, but levy limits will absolutely kill the city of Sartell.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Anybody else in the audience that would like to testify on Senate File 486? I see your colleague, Mayor Kleiss, is here. Oh, Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities. I just want to go on the record acknowledging that we support the floating of the population numbers for the Regional Center 8. That's part of our overall LGA reform position. So this is one piece of several pieces, some of which are also contained in Senator Mawaz's bill. So I just want to go on record supporting.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Question, member?
Mr. Chair, I also have 2 other individuals that have accompanied me here to the committee hearing today. Councilmember Pat Lynch from Sartell and the city administrator from the city of Sauk Rapids, Ross Olson. And if you remember at the beginning of my testimony today, I talked about the city of Sauk Rapids being just over the 10,000 and the city of Sartell being just under 10,000. And I believe that Mr. Olson would like to say a few words to the committee today as well.
Okay. Mr. Olson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, my name is Ross Olson. I am the city administrator with the city of Sauk Rapids. And I, Mayor O'Driscoll commented earlier that we work as a region. We have been able to provide a wonderful level of service, not to our individual communities, but to the communities as a whole in the greater St. Cloud area. And this is one of those proposals that we support as a region. The city of Sauk Rapids was over 10,000 in the last U.S. Census, and so we benefit from regional center aid. We have experienced similar growth. Many of the similar issues from a single-family, residential, commercial, and industrial growth perspective that Mayor O'Driscoll just testified on. The difference is we get the benefit of regional center aid. We are currently facilitating the construction of approximately a $58 million Sauk Rapids regional bridge project. It's a Mississippi River crossing. Now, with that benefit and new infrastructure comes additional maintenance costs of transportation infrastructure, and all those growth issues that I just testified on. It would be very difficult for me to fathom how we'd be able to provide those necessary services if we were not participating within regional center aid. So it's kind of strange that I'm here testifying on behalf of this, but I do understand the need that Sartell is seeking here. I do understand the necessity for them being included in the calculations for regional center aid, because I and our community do benefit from that, and it is just the right thing to do.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Fischbach, Clinton.
Mr. Chair, I think that wraps it up. I would just appreciate you. It sounds like you're going to lay pretty much everything over for possible inclusion, so I would appreciate consideration of this.
Yes. Members, we'll lay Senate File number 486 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. And thank you, Mayor. Thank you, City Administrator. And thank you, Senator.
Great. Thank you.
Senator Moi, I think we'll move to your bill. Senator Bonhoff and Bach are not available.
Thank you.
Yet.
Mr. Chair, members, thank
Senator
you for
giving us an opportunity to present to you Senate File 1046. Senate File 1046 is a proposal that's being put forth by a partnership of metro cities that includes Minneapolis, St. Paul, the Association of Metropolitan Municipalities, the North Metro Mayors, as well as AFSCME, and Mayor Kleiss. I'm really excited that he was able to make it down here to speak on this bill. The purpose of Senate File 1046 is to address the inequities in the LGA formula or the LGA program while avoiding an overall haul to the formula. The LGA formula, under which about 93% of the current appropriation is distributed, goes to cities throughout the state and treats cities the same, and it does not account for the needs that are unique to particular regions of the state. This is why separate supplemental aids have been created, especially for regional centers and small cities. This bill would add a similar supplemental aid to for metro cities using a valid policy criteria to target aid to older, fully developed metro area cities whose revenue need is increasing while their relative property tax wealth is diminishing. These cities often have aging infrastructure, aging populations, and higher service needs. The bill also uses the socioeconomic factors of percentage of rental housing and age of housing stock. These variables bear significant correlations with higher service burdens for those older, fully developed metro cities. By using these policy criteria as well as adjusting for city net tax capacity, the bill recognizes that not all metro cities are the same and tightly targets the aid. The bill is not intended to hurt other LGA cities. Growing the LGA appropriation is an important component of this bill and to keeping all LGA cities viable. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to quickly walk through the bill so that the members know what's in it. Section 1 of the bill defines metro city adjusted net tax capacity as the sum of the net tax capacity for all cities in the metro area divided by the population of all cities in the metro area. This section is meant to assure that metro aid does not go to those communities with high tax bases that do not need the extra assistance. Section 2 defines the 1940 to 1969 housing factor. The bill provides dollars in the form it's in blank in a simulation that I will be passing out to you. I believe it's simulated at $5. So it's the dollars times 3 of a city's percent of total housing built between 1940 and 1969 is greater than or equal to 43%. It's times 2 if the city's 1940 to 1969 housing stock is less than 43% but greater than or equal to 26.8%. And times 1 if the city's 1940 to 1969 housing stock is less than 26.8% but greater than or equal to 16.5%, and any cities with less than 16.5% do not qualify for aid under this section. Section 3 defines the rental housing factor, and a city qualifies to receive aid under this factor. And again, it is times 3 if its rental housing units comprise of 28 or more. Times 2 if the rental housing units are less than 28 but at least 17, and times 1 if the rental housing units are at least 7.8 but less than 17. And obviously cities with less than 7.8 do not qualify for aid under this section.
And Senator Mock, in the blank appropriation in Section 1, you had a number that you were using in your runs, or Section 2, I guess it was. Do you have a number for Section 3, the blank appropriation on line 10?
$5, Mr. Chair.
$5. Thank you, Senator.
Section 4 adjusts the inflation on a city's revenue need by comparing the most recently available annual implicit price deflator to the 2001 implicit price deflator. Mr. Chair, current law adjusts the revenue need per capita for inflation back to 2003. And given that the revenue need formula was calculated using data from the year 2000, this adjustment, we believe, or I believe, more fully measures inflation during the intervening years. Section 5 calculates city aid base for greater Minnesota regional centers over 10,000 in population based on most recent population estimates. And I think Senator Fischbach and Mayor Driscoll would be happy with this. So we're doing that instead of the 2000 census. Section 5 also removes the $2.5 million cap. And even though there's a blank in the bill, I believe that in the simulation that we'll be passing out, I've put in $4 million.
Thank you, Senator.
Section 5 is a little bit complicated, and I'm trying to see if I could be helpful. You might want to also look at the bill summary that's in front of you between the two. I think it'll be helpful, but... Section 5 increases the city aid base for metro area cities in 2008 based on its 1940-1969 housing factor and rental housing factor. For cities with adjusted net tax capacity, or the ANTC per capita, in excess of the metro average, this base aid increase is reduced by, one, the prior year statewide city average tax rate times two, the portion of the city's per capita ANTC in excess of the city metro average ANTC per capita times the city's population. And for cities with the ANTC per capita in excess of the metro-wide city average ANTC per capita, this reduces the metro base aid increase by the amount of the city ANTC per capita in excess of the metro average ANTC per capita times the average city tax rate. So the effect is that the base aid increase for Metro City under this section cannot exceed a fixed amount, which is, again, blank in the bill, but in our simulation of the proposal, the blank is $6 million, just for your information. And then in the simulation, you will also, as I've stated, the proposal with $5 in the blank in sections 2 and 3, if you the value of each factor is $15 for cities in the first quartile, $10 for cities in the second quartile, and $5 for cities in third quartile, and zero, obviously, for cities in the fourth quartile. Section 6, Mr. Chair, removes the taconite aid offset and calculating cities' revenues need. The taconite aid offset is bad public policy to begin with, and it is inconsistent with how the legislature treated other types of state aid in the past. Section 7 increases the maximum allowable aid increase from 2007 to 2008 from 10% of prior year net levy to a percentage which is blank in the bill, but in our simulation of the proposal, this blank is set. I was trying to get to where we set it at. We might be able to discern from the bill. Section 8 and Section 9 allow for the amount paid in LGA to be adjusted for population growth and inflation. Population growth is defined as the percentage of growth in population over the two most current years for which information is available, and inflation is adjusted using the implicit price deflator for state and local government purchases. This is also known as the PGSL. Mr. Chair and members, what I would like to do before I get to my two witnesses is to draw your attention to a pie chart. And I don't know if you already have that in front of you. Let me see.
We have the
colorful pie chart. This is just a pictorial depiction of what we're trying to achieve, among other things, in this bill. The first page shows the LGA distribution under current law. And you see the small city supplemental aid, the Greater Minnesota Regional Center aid, and other base aid, and then the 93.7% all other aid. If you flip to the second page, Mr. Chair members, that's the LGA distribution with the metro need aid. And reflected in here, although it's not in my bill, Mr. Chair, but I do have an amendment to do that, and I think I've spoken with you about it, is an additional bump for the small cities. Yes. And so you will see that in the distribution and in the runs that I will in the simulation that I will be handing out, I'm being optimistic in assuming about 100 million is the LGA distribution. So these percentages are calculated based on that. And you will see that there's a bump to the small city supplemental aid And that's what, and then the actual numbers are in the back, the third page for you to look at.
And Senator Ma, you mentioned the small city supplemental aid. You were talking about increasing that from 6 to 12, but you didn't. It's not included in the runs because of the discussions that we've had, or is it included in the runs?
Mr. Chair, it will not be included in the simulation that I'm going to hand out. I do have one because I wanted to see its impact. And if members are interested in that, I'd be glad to make that available to members of the committee. But because it was not in the bill, I didn't include that in the run that we're going to be handing out. But the amendment, just so that you know, Mr. Chair, members, what I had intended for in the amendment was to bump the per capita from 6 to 12. But I also have a provision in there takes out cities who are small cities that are wealthy, so that I'm going for the tightly targeting the aid to cities that really need that.
And Senator Moi, the Senate file is for the new dollars that we would be putting into LGA, leaving the existing dollars as they are spent. So this bill, just so I'm clear, applies to just the new money or to the entire LGA formula?
To the entire LGA formula. It doesn't mess with the allocation under the formula, but it does take into account the entire wait a minute now. Sorry, Mr. Chair, that was my mistake. It would only apply to the new money because it's not in the current law.
Okay, thank you. And you have Senator Kleiss, Mayor Kleiss.
The dual hands.
Mr. Chair, members, Mayor Larson will speak, and then we'll close with Senator Mayor Kleiss.
Mayor Larson.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's a pleasure to be here. I would like to thank Senator Moi for making the presentation on Senate File 1046. I am the mayor of New Brighton, but more importantly, I am the president of the Metro Cities. And being mayor for 8 years and council member for 12 years, I've seen the effects of local government aid and the disappearance of that vehicle in my community. Metro Cities represents 86 cities and 7 county metro area, including core cities, fully developed cities, developing cities, and urban fringe cities. I'm also past president of North Metro Mayors Association. We look at property taxes, and I think this bill would drastically reduce the dependence on property taxes in a community such as New Brighton in fully developed cities. We have to provide the sanitary sewers, a clean drinking water, safe streets, police fire protection, and we rely on taxes to do that because we don't get any more LGA. And I think that's why it's important to look at a community that's 120 years old, that has an increasing number of senior residents staying and coming back and living in our community because it's a safe community. We pride ourselves in the services that we offer our citizens, and they basically want us to continue offering those services, but they don't want to see their taxes go up, and I agree with that. It's critical that cities of our nature receive LGA to provide the adequate services. The cuts that were made earlier have had a devastating result on our tax increases, and our citizens pay the brunt of that. In 2001, just for history, we had a split of Greater Minnesota LGA versus Metro LGA of 56-44, and in 2007, as it stands today, that split will be 66-34. So we lost 10% as Metro cities, and 10% went to the greater Minnesota. But left out in that restoration are cities like New Brighton and the New Hopes and the Brooklyn Centers and Brooklyn Parks that are fully developed, are dealing with redevelopment issues, contamination issues, rental housing issues, and crime increases. What I would like to do is support the size of the appropriation, the $100 million that the senator has put in the books. I think it's needed. It also addresses the needs of small cities. There are some small cities that shouldn't receive it. You know, my friends in North Oak should not be receiving money. I think they understand that. But that's one of those loopholes that we have to look at. But we need to look at how we can impact developing cities as well as redeveloping cities and metro as well as outstate, because everybody's in it together, and we're not there to take money away from our friends out in the Wilmers and the Alexandrias and the St. Clouds and the Rochesters. Everybody has needs. You know, we all understand those needs. So I guess I would like to ask for your support as we go ahead and deal with our issues. We need some financing help, because I don't think our citizens can absorb many more tax increases. So with that, I want to thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Artman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Mayor. Thank you for your testimony. I was interested in the numbers that you gave, the percentages. I think you said it was 56-44 and then now a 66-34. Can you give me the years of that and where you got that information?
Did you get a copy of the handout that I gave? That will tell you the exact figures.
Mr. Mayor, does that correspond or correlate with the other handout with the pie chart on it?
I haven't done the cross-reference, and I believe it does.
Senator Ortman, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I think we have a calculation of what the percentages will be under the proposal, and but it's not on this. I don't think it's on this chart. Hang on a second. I have it. Under the bill, I think the percentages work out to be about 38.6 Greater Minnesota, 61.4 Metro.
Mr. Chair, so what you're doing is shifting the percentages mostly. We're adding $100 million to the bottom line, but then we're shifting the percentages as well to address more of the metro need. Is that the intent, Senator Moore? And
Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, yes. I mean, the end result and the overall picture would be a shifting, but because we're putting money, new money, you know, into the pot, everybody would get a little bit more, not just as much as they would be if we just put it purely into the formula. The impact here, though, Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, is that if we didn't do this shift and put more money into the pot, what this bill, I think, end up doing is it does bring some cities into getting some LGA that wouldn't otherwise get it if we just allocate the new money purely under the formula. And so it allows, you know, cities that wouldn't necessarily get it to come into the formula versus, I think, if we just did it purely without what we're doing here, some cities still wouldn't get it even if we put new money in.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Moore, do you know which cities would newly qualify for LGA under your proposal?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, I'm going to pass out the runs. I know, Mr. Chair, myself, if I were sitting there and I had the runs in front of me, that's all I'd be looking at. And I wanted the two mayors to speak. And then I'll pass out the runs and we'll take questions.
Very good. Thank you.
Mayor Kleiss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Dave Kleiss, the mayor of the city of St. Cloud. And I appreciate the opportunity to testify in front of this committee and had an opportunity recently on an issue talking about a regional center and costs and transportation, which also affects the property taxes, as was discussed. I'm here to support Senate File 1046 and kind of give you our perspective from a regional center. The city of St. Cloud, we have 65,000 residents, but on a daily basis that more than doubles. There's about 150,000 people on a daily basis that are in St. Cloud working, shopping, and in need of the services that often the property taxpayers pay. So that partnership that we have with the state, that local government aid that helps in that, and as a former legislator who was a strong advocate of local government aid while I was here, that hasn't diminished at all. In fact, I'm still very strong local government aid, especially when it comes to regional centers. Now, the city of St. Cloud, we're in a particular issue because, again, the amount of folks that come into the area from our outlying communities from those if you will, those first-ring suburbs of our regional center and those services that we have to provide. Also, we have another issue. We have a lot of federal and state entities in the city of St. Cloud. We have the largest state university in the Minscu system in St. Cloud. We have the technical college, a large technical college, the St. Cloud Technical College. We have federal establishment, the VA. We have the hospital, the prison, and MnDOT. So we have a number of state and federal institutions in our community that don't pay property taxes, but again, those services and those issues that are key to a regional center that our citizens have to pay for on those services. So we're a city of 151 years old, and we have a lot of those challenges, but the also the issue is we have a lot of services. For example, just last fall, our voters approved, fortunately, a bond for a new police station. We'll be building a police station and two additional fire stations. Now, public safety is one of those issues that, because of all the influx of folks that we have in the community as a regional center, shouldn't be the burden directly of only the property taxpayers. And again, that's where that partnership with the state and local government aid, in particular for regional centers, makes sense. So, again, I support this piece of legislation for a number of reasons. Certainly, the overall appropriation into the program for all cities, but in particular regional centers and metro area, that's, I think, it's important. But also that inflationary factor that's in there, too, that I think is important. We have a policy, at least in the city of St. Cloud, for our budget in itself. We don't raise the rate above our policy is growth and inflation. One of those issues that's difficult, and particularly as housing over the last 10 years, the housing valuations have been double-digit for a number of years. We're seeing that change in St. Cloud and all over the city, actually all over the state and the country. So that's a difficult issue. That inflationary factor will also factor in those costs that increase automatically, whether they be for public safety, whether they be wages and benefits or other things that automatically increase with the city. So, again, in particular as a regional center, when we provide all of those services for, again, those outlying communities, but also for the state entities, whether they be higher education, whether they be prisons, whether they be MnDOT, whether they be federal and the VA, it's important. And as a regional center, those services, and that's why I think it's important that we continue and enhance those partnerships that we have with the state. And that's what I think local government aid does. It does that because, again, it's important not only, as mentioned, for the metro area, because those services and those built-out communities, but also for those regional centers throughout the state, I think it's important. And as part of the amendment and for those other cities, again, this isn't detracting from any community's local government aid. It's actually adding in some of the costs and trying to shift that burden from the property taxpayer. That's a tax that... no matter anybody you talk to, the worst tax that people, that's probably the most unfair, is that property tax burden. And that's important that we get a way to partner. We all pay income tax and state sales tax, and it's important that those dollars help offset that tax that is grossly unfair, and that's the property tax, and that's the way we partner as cities with the state.
Thank you, Mayor Kleiss. And Mayor Kleiss, as we move through this session and trying to find ways to bring property tax relief to Minnesotans and all across the state, one of the things that we're going to try to balance out is the whether we offer the property tax relief in the form of aids or if we give property tax relief directly to the the taxpayer through the personal tax refund program, commonly known as a circuit breaker. Do you have any thoughts on that with regard to St. Cloud and how that would play out?
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think a combination of circuit breaker certainly is something that helps, but I think direct aid, again, in particular, as I mentioned, the cost on those services for a citizen in St. Cloud. If you look at the public safety, for example, we're, as a growing community, adding a $37 million police and fire facility, certainly the debt service on that, but we're also having, because of those services and the population that in the area, adding 12 new police officers and 13 new firefighters. That's a cost directly borne by the property taxpayer without some type of partnership. Local government aid helps ease that. So I think when you look at that, if you're talking about on the circuit breaker for those individuals based on income, I think that's part of that. But also for those communities, in particular those communities that have those services, I think that's important. And also in the previous discussion, as I mentioned earlier, transportation costs when it comes to municipal state aid, those things are the only other option for cities to pay for those types of things. And again, as a community such as St. Cloud, we have a lot of road projects that we have that, basically based on the influx of folks in the outer area, we have to increase the road and the capacity. So all those things, a combination. I think a balance is what's probably needed in that respect. But I can't stress enough that that need to help alleviate that property tax. And we have, if you look at the population of St. Cloud, if you look at renters, for example, we're above 50% in the city of St. Cloud for those who rent. So, and again, there are costs and there are challenges for a number of reasons, on the issue. But something that, again, whatever again the legislature comes up with, what you come up, you have a difficult decision. I don't envy that. I actually enjoy my position now as mayor. You have a tough challenge ahead of you, but I think it's extremely critical that, and you know, as we did when there was budget challenges for the state, we all shared in that. And now, when there's ability to help with property tax, which again I think is the most unfair tax we have. I mean, if we could do away with it, completely eliminate the property tax, and figure out some other way to do that, I think that would probably be a better direction to go. But right now, it's difficult for folks, especially in an aging and a growing community, to deal with having to pay a service for folks that that have that service or provided that service but aren't paying. And so I would say a combination of what you're talking about, but also if I can at least throw in a plug for regional sales taxes, those things also help. We cooperate regionally in our area with all of the area cities. A regional sales tax, voter approved, also helps offset some of those issues when it comes to paying for some of those services.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mayor Kleiss, I suspect that this legislature is going to send to the governor a tax bill that probably has some new local government aid in it. Even the governor proposed a very modest increase. What would your position be? I mean, if the number turns out to be rather substantial, what would your position be about the legislature imposing some kind of a levy cap on to make sure that cities didn't take the state money and then continue to increase their levy and kind of double dip on the taxpayer? How about some kind of a levy limit increase as a part of the bill, just to make sure that that we actually do hold property tax increases down? Oftentimes the criticism, Mr. Chairman, is local government aid doesn't always provide property tax relief. Mayor, what do you think?
Mayor Kleiss.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bach, my position hasn't changed as a legislator, as a mayor. I don't support those types of caps. But if there's going to be a cap, there's one issue. For example, in St. Cloud, as I mentioned earlier, we had a public safety referendum last year where we put to the voters the issue of building a new jail and two additional fire stations. Now, we also, when we put that to the ballot, we told the voters, we were very clear in all the runs that we gave, we said we're also going to hire 12 additional police officers, 13 firefighters, and here we're also going to tell you how much additional electricity it's going to cost because of the additional space, all of the additional costs. We brought that to the voters. Now, on the ballot, the only thing we could put was the debt service and the bonds. But we were very clear to everybody that this is what's going to be the cost. Now, if there was a cap, now we went to the voters approved, knowing full well that this was going to be the increase or the impact on their property taxes, the additional staffing, the additional cost of operation. That cap would basically negate what the voters approved from that public. The voters approved of the public safety for fire and police. We separated them out on the ballot. We were very clear. So that cap would be difficult, problematic. So if there is going to be some type of limit, at least in the area of public safety, I hope there's some flexibility. I think we as elected officials make these decisions. There's obviously turnover in these seats. I'm an example of that. So therefore, whether it be council or whether it be mayors, when that local government aid comes and there's a change on the property tax, folks are held accountable. But if there's going to be there for areas of growth, I hope that at least that's factored in, because again, we have a lot of we rely on our property tax right now. We have a policy from the administration and from the council that we only increase based on growth, the levy, growth and inflation. The rate actually in the last 2 years has actually gone down, capturing the growth in inflation. So if you cap that and don't allow that cap to capture the growth in inflation, that additional services that are needed because of that growth would be problematic. But again, I'm more of the advocate of local control and, you know, allow those local officials to make that decision. But if there's going to be some type of a limit, I would hope there'd be some flexibilities, at least for something that the voters approved or in the case of growth in those communities that are growing.
What? Senator Buck.
Mayor Kleiss, the governor proposed for some selected cities that any new local government aid they receive be spent on public safety. That's a growing concern in St. Cloud, I sure. How would you feel if we said St. Cloud had to spend their new local government aid on public safety purposes?
Mayor Kleiss.
Mr. Chair, will be any new local government aid was going to be put on public safety again based on the referendum we had. So that's already going to happen. That's where our greatest need is, the public safety area. A lot of those services I talked about earlier is that we pay for the doubling in population on a daily basis is in public safety. So we're comfortable with that because that's where it's going. I would prefer that local control aspect be in there. You allow the local officials to make that decision. They're held accountable based on the voters. But if that's going to be the case, public safety is where we're going to be putting it. So for our purposes, I can only speak for the city of St. Cloud. For our purposes, that's where it's going to be going, fire and police.
Oh, well, thank you, Mayor Kleiss. And, you know, it's good to have all the folks coming. It's interesting as we think about, you know, the local government aid and the need factors that are in the the local government aid formula. And Senator Moy, you know, you're presenting the percentages to us as to where the dollars go. Apparently that the need factor is not working. But I'm wondering if we will have to take a look at growth and tax rate and that those factors as we move forward on with our local government aid program this year. As we went into this session, I was thinking that we weren't going to do a lot of formula changes. We just had a pretty major redo with regard to the need factors, and I see that there are pressures building to take a look at that, but I'm not sure that this is the year. But we'll certainly take a good look at what you've got proposed here, Senator Howe. Do you have more people that you would like to speak, Senator Waugh?
Mr. Chair, we have Mayor Donovan.
City Manager.
Donovan?
Dan Donahue.
Here, he'll answer questions, but, you know, if you're tight up against time, he was here to just answer questions. Mr. Chair and members, would you like to speak? As he's coming up, Mr. Chair, you have the simulation, and as part of that simulation, it's also a simulation on the cities and the quartiles that I talked about. It's a little bit confusing in language, but we thought we'd present it in picture format for you to look at to see which cities will fall in which quartile under the metro needs factors for rental housing and for aging homes. And then you also have the simulation for all cities under the bill. And Mr. Chair, before we leave, can you advise me on what we should do with the A1 amendment? I'd like to pass that out, or should we just kind of leave it? And
Senator Roth, why don't we pass the A1 amendment out and get it on the table so people can take a look at that as long as we have it here?
Yeah. It's just that we've made a couple of references to it, and I just wanted the members to have that. And Mr. Yeah. Chair, members, you will know that I had a number of concerns, both here in the property tax division, in the hearings when we heard from small cities as well as townships, and then in the transportation committee when we heard from the same groups. And it really hit me hard at how hard hit at these small cities and townships were by the cuts and reductions. And so this is my small way of trying to address small cities. I still haven't found a way to help townships yet, but this is a small way to address the needs of small cities.
And Senator Moy, maybe Mr. Donahue could help us with this metro cities group by quartile. What are the quartiles? What are you factoring when you're determining the quartiles? Help me understand what's going on with this piece of paper.
I think I'll ask Bill.
Yeah, sure.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Barnhart. I'm with North Metro Mayors.
Mr. Barnhart.
Since the bill makes reference to quartiles, people have asked us which cities are in the top one-fourth, middle one-fourth, et cetera. So what you've got here is the grouping based upon the housing being built from 1940 to 69 and also the rental. Do keep in mind, though, we have another little provision in the bill that says if you are very wealthy, you know, it doesn't matter what these are, you know, you would not get it. So if when somebody says who in fact is in the, you know, the top of rental housing, I haven't got my glasses. Spring Park has the greatest percentage of rental housing. Hopkins is next, you know, in the metropolitan area. So you could get a sense, although some of these may get ruled out because of the being too wealthy. For instance, if you look at the percentage of 1940 to 1969 housing built, the city of Edina, in fact, has most of its housing built in that time. But the city of Edina has such a huge property tax base that it doesn't matter. They wouldn't receive.
And Senator Wall, I don't know if Mr. Barnhart or Mr. Donahue would be the ones to answer this, but as we look at this, can you help me with what the relationship is to the needs of these communities, you know, by whether their housing is pre-1940 or 1940 to 1969? And I can understand that if we change the formula to include these groupings, that it does provide money for these communities. But what's the connection between the housing percentage in that category and the need of that community?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, generally speaking, that is a good indication of the age of all the housing. I'm going to talk about housing first, and then I'm going to actually let Mr. Donahue maybe address the rental. The age of housing, when you've got whole communities, such as a classic example is Brooklyn Center, which was built in a period of about 1955 to 65. All of the infrastructure, the streets and that, were built at the same time. It's saying that this particular community has most of it have been developed more than one generation, sometimes as long as two generations ago, and are reaching that point in time where at the municipal level, redoing this infrastructure is becoming a major concern. Dan, would you like to talk a little bit about the rental housing as it relates to the service demands upon municipalities?
Well, I'll speak for the City of New Hope, which I'm Dan Donahue, City Administrator for the City of New Hope. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. As the Administrator of New Hope, I can speak about New Hope, and we're much like Brooklyn Center and City Hopkins, basically built prior to 1970. I would say probably 90% of our development was in that pre-war up to 69. We have 43% of our housing, 8,600 housing units, 43% is in rental housing. Tremendous amount of need goes into that rental housing. Most of it is 40 years old. We've had to actually shut down buildings, close them down, unoccupied. Can't buy them, so we have a problem with just providing the basic infrastructure and making sure that the amenities are of these rental units are going to our citizens. We're finding they're not. We're just having a tremendous amount of problems with the infrastructure to provide decent housing in many areas. What we're trying to do is, one of the things we're trying to do is that we had a 15% increase in Class 1 crimes this year. And we were looking at what is the allocation of rental housing to the rest of our housing in the city. And there is a preponderance of crime, and this is tough to relate. I don't want to talk about correlations, but it is tough to really zero in that apartments or rental housing has a higher incidence of crime. But talk to our police officers, talk to our public safety people. There's clear-cut evidence on their
in their minds that there is a high association. But we're having a tremendous amount of problem in just providing infrastructure to the city in general and rental housing in particular because of the age and the deterioration and the problems it's causing citywide.
Thank you. Senator Waugh.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, you know, earlier today when Mayor Driscoll was here and he talked about Sartell being a growing city, even though they have new homes and new population, newer homes, the growth of the population in and of itself has imposed a lot of needs on Sartell as a regional center. And I think that the needs of the metro cities or the small cities or the cities and these regional centers, the factors may vary. I mean, some of them may depend on growth in population. Some of it may be due to deteriorating infrastructure. But the need factor is there. And the reason for you know, doing the supplemental aid is to recognize that under the formula, it doesn't necessarily always address all the different needs, whether you're a small city or regional center or metro city. And so from a policy standpoint, we've tried to address that by creating some supplemental aids to these other cities or other regional centers that have needs. And the public policy is there to help recognize that the distribution is not equitable and that there's some needs are not necessarily addressed. And that's why we're willing to take a look at creating these supplemental aids to help equalize that. So, you know, part of what we're trying to do here is to create some solution that will address some of that need without disturbing the rest of the formula.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to speak in favor of Senator Moore's bill and talk too about, you know, I think that this chart that was passed out shows that a large result of the formula change, I guess, well, my point is that in addition to there being significant cuts in 2003, the formula changes were really disproportionately affected some inner ring suburban communities too, and I appreciate your concern about that and Chairman Bach's concern for some of the inner ring suburbs, but I think this bill really also helps to address some of those inequities where it looks at communities like South St. Paul where they really have a lot of older housing stock, mm-hmm. older citizens living in that community, and some of the cuts that were implemented in 2003 really had a disproportionate burden fall on those communities. And I think if you look, too, at the net tax capacity that individuals in suburbs or some of the regional centers are paying in comparison to other areas of the state, you'll also see some real sharp distinctions. And you know, that's just further further magnifies the need for this type of bill.
Yes, Senator Seaman. I think that part of the problem is that we have communities with increasing values and not increasing populations. They're already fully developed, and we certainly face a lot of that out in rural areas where there are increasing values, but the population is not increasing to go along with that, so the need factors demonstrate that there isn't a need there where there is. So we'll certainly be taking a look at that as we go through this LGA issue this year. As I said earlier, I was hoping to not have a complete redo of the LGA formula, but we'll see if we go that far or not. Senator Bach.
Chairman, Senator Sieben, the 2003 reform had impacts on more than just inner ring suburbs.
I know.
I've got a lot of cities in my district that actually are losing local government aid every year, actually getting less the next year as those changes are being phased in. And I notice here on the run that Senator Moore handed out, even after you put $100 million in, we have small cities all over the state that still get no new aid. So, and I appreciate the fact that the A1 amendment might make an effort to try and address that, but there are a lot of small towns that are going backwards and have a lot of need, and somehow we have to find a way to keep them whole too in this process.
Yes, Senator Bakken. As I'm looking through the list, you know, I'm looking at Ada and Bagley and Clearbrook and the number of communities that I represent, and they're something will have to be done to address the needs in those communities.
Senator? One of the things that I think people did not understand 2 years ago when they established a small city aid at $6, not every small city got the $6 because if you were in from the 2003, you had a permanent aid amount that was here, you were being phased in. What we attempted, and I, you know, maybe it should be reworked, we attempted when we in the amendment there that would go from 6 to 12 to address that so they would get the 12, you know, regardless. And then also, as was, I think, referenced by Mayor Larson, we did put in the concept that if you are very, very wealthy as a small city, maybe you don't you know, need that particular type aid. So, again, we were trying to address that. Maybe we didn't do it perfectly, but we're very aware so that my hometown of Delavan, Minnesota, with 233 people, can at least get its $1,400 for the six.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you can help me with the operation of the bill. I'm looking at the quartiles that you've set out for the rental housing percentage, and in particular, I'm looking at the treatment for the city of Wayzata. City of Wayzata is in the first quartile of the rental housing with a big percentage of 39.55, but most people would recognize that they have pretty high market value out in Wayzata. And you've said that they would be taken out of the operation of LGA somehow in this bill. I'm hoping you can talk to me about that. And then when I look at the run, they get no increase in LGA at all. So I'm wondering, can you show me how Wayzata gets taken out and what happens with that operationally? Does everybody else get moved up and Wayzata goes to the bottom? Or how does Wayzata get treated and what happens here?
Mr. Barnard?
The bill is so structured that you get those dollar amounts for being in the quartiles provided you are at, without any adjustment, at or below the average tax capacity per capita for the metro area.
Can you show me where that is in the bill?
Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, that's in Section 5 of the bill. And it is the language, you look at the language and it is very confusing. I mean, I've read it a number of times and, you know, it's still blurry in my head. I think Senate Counsel's summary actually does a really good job of laying that out, but you'll have to read it a couple of times to catch that, too.
Well, Mr. Chair, could Senate Counsel explain what how it's set up here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, the language that deals with that adjustment would be on page 8. Oh, let me just double check that. On page 8, when we're dealing with the city aid base for cities located in the 7-county metropolitan area, the adjustment, the language beginning on line 5 provides for the increase, and then there's a further adjustment there beginning on line 9 that deals with the population, the tax effort rate, and the difference between the particular city's net tax capacity per capita and the average and its population. So all of these factors work together with the effect that if a city has a substantially greater than average for the metropolitan area net tax capacity per capita, their increase that would otherwise occur under this provision would be reduced.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Ortman.
Yeah, for Senate Counsel, is there another formula for reducing then the aid, or are they just taken out of the run?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, the local government aid formula under current law, as well as continues under this proposal, is a set amount. There's an amount that's appropriated each year for distributions to cities, and then there are a couple of additional pools. But in general, the aid amount that goes to cities is set in law. So if there's a factor in the formula that either increases or reduces the aid to a particular city, then the amount that's increased or reduced remains in the pool to be redistributed among the other cities that qualify.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Moy, is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate File 1046? Mr. Flaherty.
Denham, you can put your name.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Flaherty, and I'm here representing the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities, which is 70 cities located outside the metro area. I do have just one-page handout here that I'd like to have distributed. First, let me say that there are many of the provisions of the bill that we do support. There is one, of course, that we would oppose. The things that we support in the bill are the removal of the taconite offset, which we've fought over for years and tried to change. The changing of the need inflation factor to account for growth in the need from 2001, going back to 2001, not 2003. Although our view is that it should go all the way back to 2000, so you make the need and the revenue subtracted from it equal. The use of the current population for regional center aid, which I think you've already heard about. The increase of LGA for inflation in the future, we think that's a very important thing. Now, so these are the things that I think we would agree with the Metro Cities group. And of course, all of this is contingent upon having an increase in funding, a significant increase in funding. But we're very concerned because, of course, we go back to 2001 when a lot of changes were made. And then in 2003, we had some cuts that didn't really follow the increases that were made in 2001. So if you put $100 million in this year and take it away a year from now, we're concerned about how, when you put it in, how the cuts fall when you take it away. And so we're going to be discussing that some more with you. We do agree in increasing aid for some of the metro cities that were dropped from the LGA formula in 2003. We didn't really agree with the formula in 2003. And we didn't agree with its impact on the lower wealth suburban communities. What we disagree with is setting up a separate aid formula for the metro area now. And if you do that, we would prefer to revisit the entire need side of the formula. We think that really that's not going to get us in the right direction here. We do agree with a supplemental aid program that would perhaps fill in the gaps in the local aid formula, and much of that money would go into the lower wealth suburban communities. Apparently, one of the reasons, and in the legislation we'll be talking about later, we took the new money and basically divided it 50-50 metro, non-metro. This proposal would put 60% in the metro area and 40% in greater Minnesota of the new money. The page I just passed out really gets to the heart of the issue. We do get, 66% of the LGA in greater Minnesota now, but we have 24% of the adjusted net tax capacity. LGA is supposed to be an equalization program. It's supposed to be a major component is for the tax base, and it's supposed to put more money in those lower tax base communities. So when you start coming up with new need factors and various things, it seems to us it's a problem. So we don't think the formula right now is imbalanced, but we do agree that there were inequities for some of the metropolitan communities, and we would like to see that corrected, just in a different way than I think in this bill. The other thing that I would just mention is that not only the amount of money that you put in is kind of important and how you distribute it, but it's also important to look at the bigger picture of what you're doing on county and school property tax relief. Many of the suburban communities had large property tax increases because of failure to keep up with school equalization programs, and we think that should be looked at and addressed as a way to get property tax relief to a broad base of the suburban communities. Now, having said that, we would like to work with you and other members of the Metro Cities Group and legislators to try to reach some agreement on this, but I just have to tell you we are concerned about setting up that separate aid program. We would prefer to handle some shift of funds of the new money to the metro area in a different way. So that concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Flaherty. Do you have any comments with regard to the specific need factors, the rental housing and the pre-70 housing and the rental factor? Do you have any thoughts on those two?
Mr. Chair, I think Steve Peterson from our office has some thoughts, and we are working on issues, but we just wonder if that's a significant correlation factor. When we set up the new need factor back in, was it 83? I can't remember, but we're wondering about what the correlation is to revenue base and which is levy plus aid, seeing how that fits into the big picture there. But I guess we're just saying, look, if we're going to make that major a change, then maybe we should look at the whole need factor and think about redoing that. Our approach is more to say the need factor that we have right now is a little flawed. Let's fix the gaps or the problems in it, but let's leave it pretty much there instead of setting up a whole new formula, really.
Thank you, Mr. Friday. Anyone else? Mr. Carlson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Gary Carlson with the League of Minnesota Cities. I'll be very brief. As Mr. Flaherty indicated, there are several pieces of the bill that we strongly support. Section 4, adjustment for inflation. Section 5, the regional center population adjustment. Section 6, eliminating the taconite aid inclusion in the formula. Section 8, restoring the cuts or restoring at least a portion of those cuts, as we have an open appropriation in the bill. And then Section 9, the inflation adjustment to the overall appropriation on an ongoing annual basis. On the issue of the other pieces of the bill, we have no specific positions. In our community of cities, we discussed the LGA formula back in July when we started our policy development process, and there was some acknowledgement of shifts that were occurring, but at the time we developed our policies, we didn't have a strong recommendation to the legislature. I think Senator Mois' bill brings forward one idea as a way to help adjust some of the rough edges of the LGA formula. I think Senator Scogin has a bill that you will discuss, I presume, at a future hearing. Senator Bach has Senate File 1, which also has some adjustments for LGA that we strongly support. So I'd urge you to work on this issue. I think that there is some common ground that we can find to help adjust some of the formula rough edges that need to be addressed this legislative session. And with that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Senator Moi.
Mr. Chair, I know that a lot of our cities have needs. It doesn't matter what size and where they are in the state of Minnesota. I think there are lots of good ideas being put forth, and the bottom line is that our citizens in our cities need relief. And so I'm proud to bring forth this idea. I'm willing and ready to work with, you know, anybody who have great ideas, because I think that this committee and all of us are committed to bring some relief to our cities. I want to do it in the way that will give us some flexibility in the future. I know long term, Mr. Chair, you would like to take a look at this, and I thought that this idea would help us in the meantime, but give us an opportunity to do a little bit more work, to look at the bigger picture. And this wouldn't disturb the entire picture, but give us an opportunity to provide some relief. Bottom line is, Mr. Chair, you know, I have to I represent my city, and all we ask for and how we get treated is we want the restoration, but I've heard the message loud and clear. Give cities predictability and reliability and stability and how we're going to choose to help them. And I know that my mayor is not here today, but the message is, if you're going to give us something and then make us jump off a cliff a year from now or 2 years from now, that's not reliability and that's not predictability in how we manage at the local level. And so, you know, with this bill, I'm trying to address a little bit of that. I have a volatility bill that I have put in the hopper, and I hope we get a hearing to, in case, given what we do, it's not hinged on this bill, but it's hinged on whatever, you know, package we put together in LGA to help with the soft landings the cities will have to address. And but at the end of the day, I mean, I think we've heard the message, and which is that give us reliability, give us predictability so that we can manage at the local level. And this is my way of helping that. And I hope, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, that you you will consider including this bill in the overall consideration of LGA solution this year.
Well, thank you, Senator Moore. And Mayor Coleman was here the first day we met. So we've certainly heard from the Mayor Coleman, and we will try to bring a balanced bill forward and pay particular attention to that. So thank you. With that, we'll lay Senate file.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Very briefly, Senator Moore, I can see how complicated this bill is and how difficult it's been to work on, and I appreciate all of your efforts. One of my concerns is the new dependence on LGA. You're saying that new cities now will have LGA funds, and I'm concerned about that. I'm not sure which ones they are. And if you have that information, I'd appreciate that. If you looked through this formula and did a run and identified which cities would newly be added to our LGA formula, it would help me. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll lay Senate File 1046 and also the A1 amendment over for possible inclusion in the Senate property tax article. Senator Bach?
Here. No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This issue was brought to my attention over the course of the campaign season, actually, when I met my witness, Mr. Minardi, who has a licensed manufactured home dealership in Duluth. In that the Department of Revenue has recently interpreted the law when it comes to model homes that are sitting on his property, that those model homes that are there for display purposes are being taxed at the commercial industrial tax rate. And it's a recent interpretation by Revenue and being enforced by the St. Louis County Assessor. And so I bring this bill forward. I think the legislative intent never was for a model home to be included in the commercial industrial tax base of a piece of property. It's there just a short-term period of time so that they can use it for a display. And Mr. Chairman, Mr. Minardi can better explain this than I can, but I think it would be fair to exempt those properties from property tax, unless they were there for, you know, a long period of time. I just don't think that they should be taxed as commercial industrial.
State your name for the record. Dean
Minardi, Easy Housing in Duluth.
Mr. Minardi.
As a business owner, I did talk to Senator Bach about this, and to bring you a little bit up to speed, I'm a partner in a manufactured modular home sales center. And basically, manufactured homes for years have been exempt, and recently there was an interpretation that modular homes be taxed at a commercial rate. So that's why we're here. We would like to put everything on the same playing field with our manufactured homes and modular homes because they are display homes. They're simply there as a temporary fixture for display purposes only.
Well, Mr. Minardi, so you're building and moving these homes on and off your lot. How's the assessor determining what's the value of, you know, on the day that he's doing the assessment?
It was our understanding when he visited our sales center this fall, what he it was imposing to do is tax us based on the value or the cost that we pay for that modular home at the commercial rate as if it was there through the calendar year. So in other words, if we had zero homes there when he showed up, then we would be taxed with no modular homes. However, that's not the case. We have approximately anywhere from 9 to 12 modular homes on display at any given time. So it would be just for that calendar year, was my understanding, is how he would tax us.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, is the point that it's not a permanent fixture on the property? It's temporary. So the difference between that and a model home in a community would be that it is a permanent fixture on the property. The model home, because they actually sell that model home, and yours is a sales facility, and so it's constantly changing. Now it may be changing every 2 months or 6 months, but it's not a permanent fixture to the property that improves the value of the property itself.
Senator Ortman, I think that's correct. These model homes almost always have electricity hooked up to them because you have to have lights for people to come through them, but they rarely have other utilities hooked up to them. Water or sewer, they're there just as a display piece to be able to, you know, merchandise a home that somebody might want to order, might pick some ideas out of model homes and put their own dream home together.
Well, and Mr. Chair,
Senator Ortman,
because it's not a residential area, it could not possibly be taxed as a residential property anyway. Isn't that true?
Mr. Chairman and Senator, that is correct. I also am a spec builder with modular homes. So that is taxed as a residential rate because that's no different. It's going into a residential development. So there are two separate issues. Although we're being taxed on the display sales center with the modular homes, although they're not permanent.
Let's bring the department up. Mr. Hagan, can you shed some light on what you're doing here?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Hagan. I'm with the Property Tax Vision. At the outset, I'd like to say we support this bill. There's sort of a no man's land in the area of modular homes, where, as the witness testified, manufactured homes are exempted as inventory when they're owned by a licensed dealer. And if the problem that occurs in the law is there's no provision for exempting modular homes that are set up as a display unit like manufactured homes. It's real obvious when you drive on 35E up to Duluth. I'm not sure who owns them, but there's a whole bunch of display models there. And every time I drive by them, I get nervous about what their tax consequences are because I don't think anybody wants to tax them. The Department of Revenue doesn't advocate taxing them, and the assessors don't. The problem is there's no clear provision to exempt them. Which is why we do applaud this bill.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hagan. And I guess, Senator Bach, with that, we'll lay Senate file number 978 over for inclusion in the property tax article.
Thank you
for coming.
Mr. Chairman.
Appreciate it. And, Senator Bach, you've got 1065.
Mr. Chairman, Senate file 1065 is a proposal that will help veterans that are 100% disabled. I believe there are slightly over 2,000 households in the state where there are 100% permanently disabled veterans living in those homes. And what this provision would do is say that if you're a 100% disabled veteran, you're exempt from having to pay property taxes. I don't think we need any witnesses, Mr. Chairman, to understand that this is a good proposal and a good thing to do. There's a very, because there's only slightly over a couple thousand of these, the amount of shifting that would happen onto other property in our communities, I think, is very, very insignificant.
And Senator Bach, this bill went through the Committee on Ag and Veterans Affairs. Did they get the definition of veterans squared around? Has that been, was that an issue?
Mr. Chairman, this bill hasn't been there. This is the first place that that it's been heard, but we certainly can check with them and see if we have the definitions correct.
Okay. Senator Bach, we've had a number of these types of bills in that committee, and I know there's been some discussion to make sure that the definition is correct, so you might want to check with that.
We will do that. And I should say, Mr. Chairman, so that this is clear, if the disabled veteran passes away, this exemption will pass on to their spouse for as long as they own the property or are living.
Questions, members? Committee will lay Senate file number 1065 over for possible. Oops, there's someone, Mr. Moe. I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I'm Robert Moe, the Otter Tail County Assessor. I'm here speaking on behalf of the MAO. We are fully in support of this bill, allowing the exemption. However, there's one portion of the bill that we would like to get clarified a little bit better, and that would be the area regarding the application or the documentation for the assessor. Right now, it really leaves it pretty open as to what's required, and if we could get a better direction on to specific requirements that we'd be required to get. Right now, you would have 87 different county assessors possibly doing it a number of different ways. Otherwise, we support the rest of the bill.
And so, Mr. Moe, you're wanting us to address the supporting documentation provision?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
And you have some suggestions?
Mr. Chair, I think that possibly the veteran service organizations may have some documentation that they provide. Also, the DD-214, the discharge papers, would that in combination with some type of a disability document would sound to me like something that would be possible.
Well, Senator Bach, maybe when we check with the Committee on Veterans Affairs, if we're getting that definition, they would have some ideas about what supporting documentation would be.
Very good.
Thank you, Senator Bach, and thank you, Mr. Moe. We'll lay Senate file number 1065 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Should we do Senator Bonoff? Senator Bonoff. Welcome to the committee, Senator Bonoff, Senate file number 404.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm here with Mr. Carlson, who I will let speak about the bill today, but the bill that you have in front of you is a bill to increase the market value credit. And this bill is important to many communities because while property taxes have been rising all across the state, some communities will be able to take advantage of the increase in LGA that we hope will be coming from this session, but there are some communities that, in fact, won't be getting any of that. So the thing that is important about this bill both raises the value of the homes that would qualify for a market value credit, as well as increases the credit itself. And so this will affect homeowners all over the state. It will affect the homeowners in rural Minnesota, in suburban Minnesota and in our core cities. So with that, I would turn it over to Mr. Carlson to talk about the details of the bill.
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and I'm here today in support of Senate File 404. Our support of the bill is several-fold. First, as the members of the committee no doubt know, homeowner taxes have increased substantially since 2001, the effective date, the date in which the so-called property tax reform was enacted. Through 2006, homeowners' taxes have gone up 39%, and were you to extend that out to the current year, 2007, it's approaching 50%. So I think there's general agreement that relief is needed for those properties. Secondly, we support the legislation because it directs the dollars to where the relief is needed to homeowners. The second chart on the handout that I've handed out shows how $1 million spent on various aid programs parcels out in terms of relief for homeowners. For example, $1 million spent on school aid or county program aid would result in about $530,000 of homeowner relief. With city LGA, the outcome is worse because obviously if you reside in a township, you don't benefit from it, nor do you benefit from LGA if you happen to reside in a city that does not participate in the LGA formula. So Homestead Credit is basically the only one where you can guarantee that for every dollar spent, there'll be a dollar of reduction for homeowners. Third factor that's little understood, but I think is an important one, is the current mechanics of the credit have the effect of guaranteeing that most homeowners' taxes increase at a greater rate than practically any other property in the same jurisdiction. And the reason why that occurs is really twofold. One, the credit doesn't increase as the tax on the property increases. So for any future increase in tax, the homeowner is responsible for filling that gap. They pay every dollar of the increase. But secondly, under the current mechanics of the credit, it's even worse because as the value of the home increases and the tax assumably increases too, the credit actually declines. So not only is the homeowner making up for the increase in the tax resulting from whatever factors, whether it's tax rate increases or valuation increases, they're also paying an additional tax as the Homestead credit or the state payment phases out. The next couple of graphs that I have kind of show the current credit and this phase out versus what is proposed under Senator Bonhoff's bill. The first table shows that the credit under current law has a $304 peak for a $76,000 home, and then it phases out until it reaches a home of a value of about $414,000. In the meantime, the tax on that residence is increasing substantially. Comparing that to the next table, which is Senator Bonhoff's proposal, the tax reaches a peak, or the credit reaches a peak of about $332 for a home of $83,000, and then it stays at that level until it begins to phase out for a home of $381,000 in value. The other import of that is that it brings what we believe is needed equity to the program. Right now, turning to the table on the second to the last page, you have a configuration where, again, the credit peaks at $304 for a home of $76,000 in value. And then it declines, for example, to $147 for a $250,000 home, relatively modest under today's prices. Yet at the same time, the tax on that property has more than quintupled, even though the state payment has declined by over half or over $150. In contrast, under Senator Bonhoff's proposal, As I said, the credit peaks at $332 for an $83,000 home, and it stays at that level until the value of the home begins to exceed $381,000. So there's no inequity, at least in the dollar terms, of the amount of credit provided between the lower and the higher valued homes. Obviously, the homeowners in the higher valued homes will still be paying substantially more tax, but not as disparate as exists under current law. I'll conclude by pointing out this provides relief in both greater Minnesota and the Twin City metropolitan area. Over 86% of the state's homeowners should receive relief, and that's true in both greater Minnesota as well as the metro area. In greater Minnesota, over 79% of the state's homeowners should receive relief under this bill. With that, I'll conclude and be happy to answer any questions.
And Mr. Carlson, so when I'm looking at the tables, this amount of homeowner tax relief per $1 million spent, you're advocating that we would, if we're looking to affect homeowners, we would follow this proposal as opposed to some of the previous bills that we had in front of us today dealing with AIDS?
Mr. Chairman, if your objective is to provide homeowner relief, the homestead credit or perhaps the property tax refund, but with one shortcoming that I'll describe shortly, are the only programs that guarantee for every dollar you spend, there's going to be a dollar of relief for homeowners. The other programs that you've been considering in committee have the shortfall, one, that there's no guarantee that a dollar spent results in a dollar of tax relief, but further, that tax relief is spread across all properties, even those that some members of the committee, given the recent history, may really warrant relief. Again, the homestead credit is the only one that directs relief exclusively to homeowners, where I think many of you acknowledge the problem exists.
And Mr. Carlson and Senator Bonoff, I've been looking at the fiscal note here, and the 09 cost of this is $158 million, and then the 010, 011 biennial cost is $471 million. Have you looked at this bill in ways that we could find some compromise to do parts of it that are, you know, the most important and try to bring the total cost down some? Have you examined that, Mr. Carlson or Senator Bonoff?
Mr. Carlson.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, yes, there are obviously ways of bringing down the cost of this bill. One of those is to delay the indexing, which we've really kind of glossed over in the presentation. Not only does the bill increase the credit, then it provides that the values used for computation of the credit is indexed with the rate of appreciation in statewide home values. So if you delay that, that would reduce the cost of the program. Then obviously to fit with inside the parameters of whatever budget you're ultimately working with, you can modify where the phase-out point begins. Right now, this bill before the indexing anticipated the phase out would start at $350,000. If you move that further back, you will reduce your cost.
Okay, thank you. And Senator Bonoff, we're starting to bump up against session. So is there anyone else that would like to testify with regard to Senate File 404? Questions, members? Thank you. Thank you very much. We will lay
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 404 over for possible inclusion in the property tax article. Anything else, members? We will be meeting Wednesday morning at 8:30, and we'll have a full agenda then also. Committee adjourned.